Welcome to the podcast show by Keevan Devani, the Total Connector, Total Bitcoin, Austrian Economics, the hardest and scarcest money ever created in human history, Bitcoin.
Well, welcome to the Total Connector show. My name is Keevan Devani. It's a real great pleasure. It's like winning a small jackpot lottery, having Eric Vasquel, Ben Prentice, and Connor Brown together on a panel discussion. This is my second panel discussion with Bitcoin Bitcoiners, Bitcoin maximalists, or I call myself Bitcoin realists, but it doesn't really matter. Now that I talked about this, can you guys introduce yourself while I'm showing a couple of those articles that you published and your background and how you came to Bitcoin just for the newbies? Thank you so much for your time and appreciate for coming.
Starts.
Go ahead, Eric.
Eric Vasquel, I've been developing on LibitCoin for about 5 years. I've done a number of startups. Before that, I was in the Navy, in the U.S. Navy, flew airplanes off of boats, and got a computer science degree a long time ago for Microsoft as an architect and IBM way back.
I guess is that Eric right there? Is that?
Yeah, that's Eric. I was thinking, is Top Gun's movie with Tom Cruise like sort of based on the authentic story of Eric Vasquel? I was thinking, I was always like envious of the pilots. Like, I wanted to be a pilot too, but I just didn't have to think for it, probably.
The handsome young man right there.
Yeah.
Hey everyone, I'm Connor Brown. I'm currently a student at Stanford Law School. Right now I'm working at a law firm. My interest in Bitcoin was peaked actually when a friend of mine told me to write about, he was like, tell me to get in the writing. And he told me to write about blockchain technology since I was at Stanford. And I was like, oh, awesome. Started getting into blockchain. And then, the further I went down the rabbit hole, it was pretty clear that Bitcoin was really the only thing that mattered. I think that while I don't have necessarily like a technical background from like a computer science perspective, my background's in law, economics, philosophy, all that. And that's, also very important when we're talking about something that's going to change, human civilization and just the way we store our time and energy and what that means for our society. So yeah, happy to be here.
Great. Ben, go ahead. Thank you so much.
Awesome. I'm Ben Prentice. I wrote a blog one coin, but there's some shitcoinery in there. So maybe don't read that. Just follow me on Twitter and reach out to me anytime. All I do is I think about Bitcoin a lot and I talk about Bitcoin a lot, and I'm slowly falling down the rabbit hole. So come along in this journey with me.
Wonderful. All right, guys. I don't want to dictate, the course of this podcast show. I just wanted, I want to create and deliver some content value that is for the average person. All right, because I hear a lot of interviews, I hear a lot of podcasts, there's a lot of technical terminology. And to be honest with you, I'm trying, to have empathy with most people out there who have no clue, especially because it's either you are a coder, programmer, cryptographer, or really into the scene to constantly follow up on the comprehension, definition, terminology, or what it means, why Bitcoin, in the overall sense. So I have a couple of topics also in connection with Caitlin Long's last articles, systemic stability versus price stability, even down to David Bowie's interview in 1999, or Connor Brown's article on intrinsic value, store of value, a Libit article by Eric Vasquel, the podcast which Ben Prentice just recently did on Echo Chamber, on nation state initiative, like, what would happen if a nation state would go into Bitcoin, at least, fragmented, or a fraction of a Bitcoin. and I have my very specific questions, like very practical questions. And I know it's a daydreaming, but I'm so obsessed with this vision, with this wish, that what would happen if collectively a critical mass of people would wake up to the facts, like, and FOMO totally in, and every human, not every human, but let's just say 2 billion, 4 billion people all of a sudden wake up to the facts, like, hey, I need some Bitcoin and I can do it. You know, there's, it's not a, you know, it's not a secret anymore. It's not a rocket science anymore. I think everybody can at least get their hands on 0.00, whatever, 2 Bitcoin. So I know there's a lot of, I don't want to guys overload you, but I just want you to sort of co-develop this course of discussion, panel discussion with me, because there's a lot of, you know, questions out there. There's a lot of, you know, confusion and misunderstanding, miscomprehension, especially when it comes to logical deductions in Austrian economics. And that's where Eric Vosquil with this rigid, strict logical reasoning and deduction comes into play. What do you guys think are the fundamental, my first question, what do you guys think is the fundamental misconception, misunderstanding, or non-comprehension when it comes to Bitcoin? Would it be, you know, academics who are totally, you know, with their, who are totally like indoctrinated with their PhD titles and Keynesianism, or the average Joe on the street? What is it that people do not grasp about Bitcoin as a store of value? Let's just start off with the store of value.
I think people are locked in the tyranny of the status quo, that it's very difficult to like expand your worldview to something that you hadn't previously considered, especially if it's, you know, kind of radical. You know the article he has up here is called Bitcoin, Internet, and the Rock and Roll, and rock and roll was radical. It was kind of revolutionary. And the status quo at the time, you know, was people saying that, oh, that's the devil's music and stuff. And people are kind of doing that with Bitcoin, that it's, oh, it's the devil's money. You know, it's used for pornography and gambling and stuff. And to really, I think, entertain the idea of a world where people use Bitcoin, you know, a lot, is very difficult for people to grasp, because it's so far outside their realm, their worldview, where we just have, you know, we got these banks, they take care of everything. We got the Federal Reserve, they take care of everything. And to entertain the idea that there's this non-sovereign peer-to-peer network of money is very tough for people. And it takes a lot of work, I think, to think about it. I've been spending the last year doing it, and I'm still learning every day. So I think it has a lot to do with it.
Yeah, I think the nature of money as an evolutionary process is something that's really difficult for people to conceptualize. You know, a lot of people, they talk about, you know, Bitcoin can never be a store of value because it'll never be a money because, you know, it's too volatile and it can't be used as a medium of exchange. I think that, you know, it's a question of the order that something becomes a money. And something doesn't just become a global reserve asset overnight. You know, it has to go through stages, and you can't have something go from no value to trillions of dollars in value. And so that is an evolutionary process where it goes from a store of value to slowly becoming more of a common medium of exchange and then a unit of account. I think that evolutionary process is oftentimes missed. I'll leave it at that for misconceptions. I think that, people really want it to be all three things simultaneously from the beginning. And that's, I mean, it's logically impossible for something to become a reserve asset without being extremely volatile in the upward direction.
Eric, what do you think?
I think the main misconception, at least in the Bitcoin community, you know, excluding all the misconceptions of various blockchain things and shit coins, is that Bitcoin is a white market money. Bitcoin has no against its primary adversary for control over money, which is the state. It never pretended to have, you know, such a security role. But people have ascribed their desires to it. And as a result, you know, a lot of the effort put into things that pertain to Bitcoin have no security. They offer none to Bitcoin. And fundamentally, the money is about security, right? Securing it from the control of the state, letting it be independent of those controls. So in my mind, that's the most important and most significant misconception about Bitcoin, that it is, as you imply with the Bowie article, an act of rebellion, like rock and roll or the internet. And, you know, you can't be both embraced by the system and rebel from it, unless the system just doesn't care. And then you're just ineffectual. So Bitcoin does necessarily have to go through phases. And the first phase is nobody cares. It's, you know, Satoshi mining in his, you know, garage or something. And eventually people start to care because it's taking money away from the state. And that's really the idea, is to let people keep more of their own stuff. And at some point, if it becomes significant enough, the state will care. And, you know, the easiest thing for them to do is to simply say, you can't do this. Maybe you can do this Fedcoin thing, which is very similar, but you can't do this Bitcoin thing because it's money laundering. Bitcoin offers no defense from that. What it offers is the choice to participate illegally in what I call a black market money, or to stop. So anyway, that's by far what I think is the biggest misconception about it.
Yeah, I wonder, Eric, if we could discuss that a little bit, because I've heard you talk about this before, and I find it very, very interesting kind of paradigm that you're talking about. Bitcoin has value as a black market money, and I don't want to mince your words, but essentially it doesn't have value as a white market money or something along those lines. What is, if governments don't ban Bitcoin, then does it not have value?
No, it just doesn't. It's not having any effect. That's what's implied by government saying it's all cool. And that's kind of where we are now. I mean, there are certainly people are starting to take some notice, but it's not significant. And I've talked to regulators about it at, you know, very mm-hmm. high levels and heard them speak. And that's exactly what they say. It's not significant enough for them to care. When it starts actually saving people money, you know, tax money effectively through avoidance of the inflation tax or ability to transact more privately, and then they'll start to care. And they've said this. So, and it's not that it can't have value as a white market money. People value whatever they want, and it has utility in the white market. So people use it, and it has value. My point is that it can't secure that value, right? And which means it can be taken away very quickly. Stroke of a pen. So the only option at that point is to continue to operate illegally, which is what Bitcoin is designed to allow you to do. That's what permissionless means. You do it without permission.
I guess what I'm trying to get at, sorry to cut you off there. I'm trying to get at, do you think that the threat of it being so viable as a black market money almost prevents them from being able to do anything about it?
No, I think that's a common, I mean, there's several common, you know, responses to that, to my observation, or, you know, I don't know if I was the first one to observe it, but I think Satoshi at least understood it to some extent. But, you know, that's the idea that if it becomes so popular that the state right. can't ban it. Well, that's right. I consider that absurd. You know, it's possible the state won't ban it, right? I don't try to make predictions. Let me just explain the model, you know, how it works. Certainly the state can do whatever it wants, and, you know, voters can do whatever they want. But the idea, basing the idea on the fact that it's secure because it's popular is provably not true. Because most things that are banned are the most popular right. I mean, I just read an article about San Francisco, you know, banning vaping or some extent, right?
Yeah.
And the reason they used was that it was so popular among younger people. That's it. If it wasn't popular, they wouldn't have cared. So the most popular things get banned. I mean, look at the long list, you know, historically. Money's on that list, right? Gold,
Yeah.
Very popular at the time.
But I feel like banning Bitcoin is going to have much deeper repercussions than banning vaping. I mean, vaping doesn't change anything. If you ban Bitcoin and we're right about it becoming a global monetary reserve currency, then, you know, suddenly you're shooting yourself in the foot if you ban it. Like you, the game theory where like it's a prisoner's dilemma, right? You have to play or else you're going to see your own, you know, wealth just disappear if it is this black hole of value.
Well, you should use gold and not vaping probably as a better example. Very popular money around the world, right? Used by the state and eventually banned. Not only banned, but stolen. So there's existence proofs that show that that's, you know, that idea that something as popular as the world's money couldn't be banned are not true. They've happened. So,
but they still hold it.
Absolutely.
They didn't ban it and then say, and we're not going to touch it. They banned it and took
trade
it.
Trade and contract. So, as money. So, you know, the state reserves for itself the right to do whatever it wants, right? So what it wants is to be able to control the money because it taxes through the money. There's two forms of taxation through money. And, you know, one is the ability to create some of your own, and the other is the ability to see how people are transacting, that transparency that they want so they can enforce other taxes. So shooting yourself in the foot, you know, might be not letting this new technology evolve, and therefore the world is poor. State doesn't care. State is after its own revenue, not making everybody else wealthy. So you have to look at it from its perspective, not from your own. And it has different objectives, and things that it thinks are useful are different. So preserving, maximizing tax revenue is a goal of the state. And if it sees that letting Bitcoin operate reduces its tax revenue, then it won't. It's against its interest. Even if that leads to a contraction of the economy, and we've seen this in very large states, China, Russia, for example, where they decided that the state could be more powerful if we were communists. They didn't care how poor or dead people got. So their interest is not our interest, I'm speaking as individuals. So, you know, if it sees that the returns are greater for banning it, which if they're not, then what do we achieve? Right? We're not saving some of that tax money for people and making their lives better by avoiding state controls. And we're not accomplishing anything. And that means if they don't ban it, we're not effective.
Well, I would push back on that too, Eric. I think just some of the qualities of Bitcoin as a almost infinitely scalable medium of exchange have value despite, you know, I agree with you that one of the main value propositions of Bitcoin is to avoid inflation tax, but that it has other uses too.
And do you believe that those uses cannot be achieved without Bitcoin? Do you believe that the state couldn't allow people to make monies that are not decentralized and secured against these controls? We're basically asking the state to give up controls that it could give up if it wanted to and make this as easy as you described with Bitcoin. Bitcoin is actually a very expensive way to achieve these things. That expense is the cost of preventing the state from imposing these controls. It could allow better money by just allowing a free market for money, allowing it to move across borders without inflation, right? Without taking control over it. And you know, and you look back at like PayPal started out as this company called Confinity, and their objective was to allow people to circumvent currency controls.
Yeah, but they turned into a bank, right? PayPal, you know, their vision was different, but now, you know, they're working well with 30 or 40 bank licenses in different jurisdictions. Their vision was different, right?
The point is they failed. Right? Mm-hmm. Why did they fail? They realized that they had no way to allow them, they had no way to circumvent these controls and continue to operate, right? No, so if the state wanted that benefit of free flowing money around the world without inflation, et cetera, it could simply allow it. It doesn't. So saying it's in the state's interest because it will make money flow more easily is kind of a clear contradiction. They could achieve that if they wanted to. They don't.
I mean, I don't know if they could achieve it in a way that's better than Bitcoin. I mean, it seems like there's a catch 22. If they try to do something better than Bitcoin or as good as Bitcoin, then they have to give up control, which exactly. they couldn't do.
Exactly. They won't do, which is right. my point.
They won't right. give up so they can't.
Bitcoin either. Right.
I'm not saying, well, I want to go back to the gold example because, you know, you're right that they banned gold, but what they didn't do is they didn't get rid of all their gold. They kept the gold.
They didn't need to achieve their objective, right? The objective.
Well, they had to keep it because if they had, let's say the United States banned gold completely and said, it's such terrible stuff, we're just going to, you know, do away with it. We're not going to hold it. We're not going to touch it. That would be shooting themselves in the foot. So I think that maybe they'll ban Bitcoin. I can see several countries banning Bitcoin, but I can't see a country saying, we're going to ban Bitcoin and we're never going to be a part of it. They're going to ban it and probably hold it. Because they can't not, right? They can't risk it becoming the global reserve asset and they have zero.
Okay, if countries ban, if the state bans Bitcoin and holds it, what secures it? Why? What prevents them now from saying, well, we've made a few modifications? Nothing.
No, the mining, it'll still be secured by miners.
They've banned it. They've banned the mining and transacting in Bitcoin. They control it. Now they own it.
Okay, so are you saying it's going to be, I don't think it's going to be banned in the entire world, ever.
Well, I know that's what you think, but what we're talking about is why, right? Why do you believe that?
Because there's always going to be there's always going to be someone who breaks,
so you're talking
about the cartel, right?
You're talking about jurisdictional arbitrage. Some states right. can ban yeah. it, some states won't.
Yeah.
Which is a different idea than the state wants everybody to be wealthier so they'll let it continue, which is what we were talking about earlier. Right. So there's this one point on popularity. It's so popular and so useful, they won't ban it. I think that's not, can't predict what they will do, but if it becomes useful enough, in other words, it's saving people money and taking it therefore from the state, they certainly have that option and it's easy. The next point we're talking about is jurisdictional arbitrage. Not every nation state will do this. Well, that's irrelevant. When I talk about the white market and the black market, we're simply talking about it from the perspective of whatever state or set of states that are banning it, right? From their perspective, certain other states might be part of the black market. So what? That right. doesn't change the formula. People might go off to, you know, Iran, which is considered a yeah. rogue state today,
yeah.
and decide that because it's part of the Bitcoin black market from the West's perspective, they'll mine there, right? And of mm-hmm. course, people will mine in the black market. They're doing it illegally from the states that are trying to stop it. And of course, that will continue to work. That's the point, right? Bitcoin can operate in the face of a ban. It just means you're part of that relative black market. The question then is, what does the state do when it realizes it can't control the black market, right? Mm-hmm. It uses enforcement. And the way Bitcoin has an inherent weakness. It's more easily controlled from one point on the earth than any other way, right? Centralized mining is more cost effective. So the state will mine it if it bans it and wants to control it and is not effective, right?
Is it more cost effective? I mean, yeah, I don't think that
it's itself. I think it's
not knowable what's more cost effective. What, you know, whether the state feels it's losing more money to Bitcoin than it's losing by subsidizing mining censorship, but it has that option, right? The question of whether it wins that or not is not knowable because we don't know how much people will value getting their transactions confirmed, therefore paying for black market hash power in excess of the white market hash power, the censored hash power. And it's not knowable how much the state would be willing to spend in tax money to provide that subsidy. I'm not suggesting that it wins. I'm suggesting that these are the forces that I'm describing, the forces at work.
Can I ask you something? If, for example, you know, there's actually, because it's like camouflage, this whole discussion, there's literally a real, not only trade war, but a currency war going on in the background. With the intention of circumventing the dominant international reserve currency, which is the US dollar. Oh my God, are you okay? You just fell off the chair. Are you okay? You want to call the ambulance?
Stuff mouse fell off the monitor because you guys.
See, it's always the mouse. It's always the fall.
And then my shirt gave out. All right, back.
Okay, the podcasters cannot see what is going on. So back to my question. Maybe it's a really naive question, but do you think if a critical mass, for example, in Venezuela or Iran would adopt Bitcoin, isn't that undermining the forces or the dictatorship, whatever you want to call it, the regime forces of a specific country?
Yeah, of course. Undermining, literally, right? Or maybe figuratively, but undermining means mining under somebody's mind, right? interesting historical word base. But yeah, of course. So the black market, you know, tries to undermine the state. In this case, outmine the state. And it does so by the fact that when people's transactions don't get confirmed because the state is censoring with the 51% attack, their fees rise on those transactions. The state doesn't take those fees. So it incents, now there's more profit to be made by black market mining, by taking those fees. So hash power rises in the black market, and the state has the option to either accept those fees or subsidize its hash power with tax revenue. So there's a real cost to maintaining that control, that censorship over Bitcoin. And the question is whether that cost is worth it. That's really not knowable, right? Value is subjective. It's in people's minds. The value of those transactions getting through versus the value of stopping.
Well, I agree with a lot of what you say about it's really unknowable, Eric. I wonder if you would muse, since you've spent so much time thinking about this, on what you think will happen. Even though it's obviously unknowable,
you're gonna make a prediction, aren't you?
No. I'm curious if we can explore intellectually some possibilities.
Well, and the you know, I write that Bitcoin is based on, you know, three technologies or three systems that are axiomatic, you know, praxeology, or axiomatic economics, mathematics, which is again not consistent and complete. It's axiomatic.
And,
can you define the first two, Eric, for the listeners?
Before I forget the third is probability.
Probability, yeah.
Okay.
So you were asking me.
Yeah, just, you know, layman's, I mean,
praxeology is what we call Austrian economics, essentially, right? It's economics that's based on a set of assumptions. The first assumption is that humans act. Right. If they don't, but if humans act, they make decisions based on whatever they make them based on. Right. It doesn't matter. A large part of economic theory or praxeology flows from that. And there's a couple other assumptions as well. But they're assumptions. You can't prove them. Some people refer to them as inherent truths, but those are basically truths that are unproven, right? Unprovable. So mathematics is the same way. And so is probability theory. There's an assumption there that we can accept and move forward or not accept. Geometry is based on a number of assumptions, one of them being that parallel lines don't meet. Well, it turns out you can't really prove that. You just have to assume it. And if you assume that they might meet, you might end up with something like spherical geometry, right? Which is useful on the surface of the Earth. So the things about Bitcoin that matter are based on these three systems. But they're also based on one other assumption that we can't prove. Otherwise, if we didn't make this assumption, it wouldn't be Bitcoin and we wouldn't work on it. And that assumption is that the system can survive, can defeat the state. Can't prove it. And I just described to you why it's not provable. But we believe it's possible. We assume it's possible and we move forward from there. I call that the axiom of resistance, right? We assume we can defeat the state. Now, at one point years ago, Mike Kern and I had a discussion. He had discussed it, you know, with a number of people. He didn't believe that Bitcoin could defeat the state. He said, you know, Bitcoin is at some point he said Bitcoin is defended by the fact that it's popular. And when that didn't hold up, he just felt that, you know, it just really couldn't defeat the state. And he moved on to something else, right? And that's what you do when you don't accept that axiom, right? You move on to some centralized coin, you work on Ripple or, you know, some other thing. So again, whether I can, you know, what can I predict will happen? That again, it's axiomatic. You can't can't say what will happen. All you can say is how it works, and we believe that it's possible, and we can show how it's possible. But we all, in showing how it's possible, we can see that it's not provable.
I agree with all that. I also think that, you know, maybe it's not a question of the state, but it will defeat some states. I mean, I think that, you know, it's going to come down to some states will see the opportunity there and will align themselves with Bitcoin, and some states won't. And, you know, maybe in doing so, they in turn basically sanction themselves from the rest of the world and end up hurting themselves. There's always going to be a black market and white market in relative terms, you know, because any black market and white market is relative.
Yeah.
The question is,
I say the state, all I'm referring to is the group of entities that are trying to enforce their controls, and the black market is simply everybody else. The white market and the black market is relative to that perspective. It doesn't mean that a state can't be included in the black market. We see that today.
Right. Yeah, and like Bitcoin has allowed us to theorize a concept of the nation state that is separate from controlling the monetary base, which is a very new idea. I mean, and it's similar to, you know, the idea of having the church and the state, and then, you know, once the idea of determining your own religion outside the boundaries of the state, you know, became popular, then that's something that can't really be put back in the bottle. Sure, there's going to be some states that have a state religion, like as we still have today, and there might be still states hundreds of years from now that still have a state-based money, and, you know, hurt themselves in doing so. But I think that once the idea comes out, at least some states are going to go with it, because it's going to be to their own advantage to be some of the states that align their interests with Bitcoin as a global asset.
I'd make two comments. One is just maybe technical. I don't believe that Bitcoin is a new concept in terms of stateless. It's before states.
Sure.
And, you know, gold certainly is a stateless money. The problem with gold is you can't move it on a wire.
How about digital stateless money?
Yeah, it's not useful.
Right.
As useful in a global, you know, connected economy. And that's probably why the restrictions on gold were lifted. It was really not relevant anymore. People couldn't use it for most of their activity. I don't know, sorry, there was another comment I had, but the idea of certain states aligning, yeah, again, not provable what a state will do, we see this today where certain states, you know, find it in their interest to resist, I don't know, call it the West, right? They become sanctioned, whatever, get cut out of the financial system. They do that. They do it for their self-interest. And in terms of money, you can count probably on one hand the number of states that don't coin their own money, right? And because there's a tax value for doing that, some of them are so small, it's just not worth it to them. So they use the euro or the dollar, or the rand, you know. Some of them cycle through using other people's money when their own fails, like Zimbabwe. Ultimately, there's demonstrably a strong interest in having control over that tax machine. Who's to say? The black market may be big, it may be small. All we know is that it has to be enough to overpower the censor.
Based on what you think of the black market, it could be huge from one perspective and tiny from another perspective, depending on which side of it you're on. So,
yeah, I mean, ultimately, all that matters is the financial size of it, right? If people can operate in the black market to the extent where they value transacting to the point where they're going to pay a high enough fee to overpower the censor, then they'll have their money.
Exactly.
Right.
What is that critical mass, Eric, that you said, okay, there needs to be, you know, certain parameters, conditions met that the state starts, you know, censoring whatever or going against, but what would be like the, you know, the ideal condition for the state sort of to come into play and say, I, you know, we got to do something. Is there a number? Is there a parameter?
Put yourself in their shoes, right? You have a certain, you know, you have a certain tax machine. It's generating a certain amount of revenue, and all of a sudden, that revenue starts to drop. Mm-hmm. You're not able to see transactions. You describe it as money laundering, right? Mm-hmm. Money laundering is just a way to say you're transacting opaquely, right? It's mm-hmm. not transparent to the state. Okay, there's all this money laundering going on, but what you're really saying, that's a euphemism for we can't tax as effectively as we could before. And people are avoiding use of your currency, so they're not, you know, your inflation tax is dropping. And when you see that becoming costly enough, and you estimate that the cost of enforcement, whether it's political cost or, you know, monetary cost, is less than the cost of than the money you're losing, you might consider actually doing something. I mean, a rational actor would. And you can't assume the state's irrational from its own perspective. It's entirely rational from its own perspective. It's just not necessarily our perspective.
Well, what if Eric, that they are drinking their own Kool-Aid and they really do believe that the Keynesian system is working for people better than gold would have or whatever. And what, you know, it's possible when it's possible, right? It's possible that they could see that this system might actually work better for everybody.
Again, but everybody is not the objective. For the state, is the
right.
objective, right?
So, right. Well, in theory, it is, though, right? In practice, it may not be. In theory, the state's the idea is to protect liberties and to,
then we wouldn't,
you know.
We would, they would just realize that all this taxation is not good for people and stop doing it. And again, we have democracies in a lot of these states. Theoretically, the people should be able to do that themselves without having to resort to Bitcoin.
But I argue that a digital secure money couldn't have existed before Bitcoin and didn't exist before Bitcoin. So
against what? Secured against the state. That's the point, right? So it could have existed.
And secured against counterfeiters and secured against stuff, not just the state.
The market is an effective regulator until the state steps in, right? So if people make bad, if you make private monies and the private money's bad, people don't use it. So it's not necessary to have a decentralized money to have it be an effective, secure, useful money. It's necessary to be decentralized so you can hide, operate at small scale from the state.
But the fact that it's decentralized introduces some interesting properties, I think, that weren't possible before, that didn't exist before.
It's a security property. It's anonymity.
And permissionlessness, not from the perspective of, you know, the state preventing you from doing it so you have permission. I'm saying the permissionlessness of innovation, that innovation can happen at the edges. And Andreas talks about that a lot.
In free markets is unrestrained. That's the nature of markets. They can do whatever they want.
But centralized systems of money aren't able to allow edge innovation. It's not how they work.
Money is unique in that it's not subject to market forces, right? Innovation occurs naturally in the market to satisfy people's desires and demands. And the state is what prevents those innovations in the case.
Okay, I'm not sure I completely agree, but I see what you're saying.
Connor, sorry, did I interrupt you before? We were going to say something just a couple of minutes ago. Connor.
I was going to say, you know, in answer to the question of like what's going to cause states to make this decision on whether or not they crack down on it, I think something that complicates it is that money is it's just a very ideological concept. And I think a lot of people, regulators or representatives, they don't understand money like at a really foundational level. And so they see Bitcoin as a payment system and not as a money. And I think that, you know, it's strange because Bitcoin represents a massive threat to, you know, nation states around the world in terms of losing their power to control the money supply, which is where a lot of their power comes from. But the fact that people believe that money is subjective and not based on monetary properties causes them to see Bitcoin as just a payment system. I mean, when I first read about Bitcoin for months, I was like, oh, yeah, remittances. That's where the value add is. I mean, it was like it was just something I could only conceptualize as a form of payment, just because you never think on the monetary level. So I think that in some ways, that forgetting of what money is and why it's important is really helpful to Bitcoin. It almost provides this cover for it to continue to grow. I mean, if there was a deep understanding of money, I feel like this would have been banned 5 years ago.
I don't disagree with you. I mean, people don't understand money. People don't understand Bitcoin for sure. And you know, people that operate the state are individually not so aware of these things, maybe less than most. And it tends to be a slow operating, machine. But I think I agree. I think what you're saying is that, because they don't understand it, maybe there's some leeway to operate in the white market right now. But at some point, right, it may be understood that they're losing monetary revenue, revenue from the control of money to Bitcoin, whether they understand Bitcoin or not. Mm-hmm. Right?
Yeah.
And as a result, they may do something about it. I mean, the internet went through this, and the internet's not, decentralized or secured from the state in the same way as Bitcoin. But there was this kind of explicit safe harbor from taxation, at least in the United States, for a period of time where anything bought on the internet was tax-free, right? That's gone now. That lasted quite a long time. And that allowed, purchases made over the internet that used to be made over the phone, or, this is how the Sears got started, right? They started selling catalogs and selling stuff, shipping catalogs and selling stuff over the phone to people that were, setting up homesteads in the Midwest, and, which was growing like crazy, but there were not a lot of stores out there. So they created mail order, and it was huge, right? But the internet kind of came along the same way and said, well, we can subvert that whole mail order thing. And by the way, there's no tax on these purchases. So great, a great safe haven for a period of time allowed it to grow. Maybe analogous. But when sales started to get to the point where not only a lot of sales were happening, but the majority of sales were happening over the internet, guess what we got? We got tax, right? So we had no security model against that. And Bitcoin similarly has no security model against white market forces either. People can still buy things illegally over the internet. They can still do that, and they suffer the cost of enforcement. And people will be able to do the same with Bitcoin. So I agree with you. Just adding some color and some more observations. I thought we were going to talk about David Bowie.
Yeah, let's go. Punk, what do you call it? Anarcho-pop, anarcho-punk, anarcho-art. But it's we were talking before the interview, before Connor came on, Connor, with Ben and Eric, about, I remember I saw recently the other interview of 99, because the interview is from 99, and I found it so hilarious because this another interview took place with Jeff Bezos, with the same mindset of a journalist, not understanding what Jeff Bezos' vision, he was trying to say, Jeff Bezos was trying to say, I'm obsessed with the desires and wishes and needs of the customers. That's what the customer, the clients, the customers need. And the journalist just couldn't get it. It's like the same thing in this article. It's on decentralized.today. It's called Bitcoin, the Internet Rock and Roll interview and article with, based on David Bowie's art interview in 99. So what's your take on that? I mean, did you read it or should I read some quotes out of it?
I picked it up a little bit late this morning, so I only got about a third of the way through it, but I'd seen that a while back, and it's as I was saying before we got going, it's easy to kind of cherry pick out the critics who were grossly mistaken. The internet will never be more valuable than a fax machine, kind of thing. And the critics are right. So prediction's hard, especially about the future. So the people who are right in their predictions are visionary, and people who are wrong are wrong. But you know, I think at the time in 99, I mean, this was already fairly obvious. So it's a little bit late, you know, to be saying, no, the internet's not gonna do these things. I remember in the mid 90s thinking, well, you know, when just can't wait till it's inevitable, right? But you know, Bowie is seeing this as a way for people to express themselves freely, right? Which implies without censorship. You know, and the internet can be censored by the state, but there's, you know, it's just a connection of computers to each other. It doesn't require, you know, large scale state, you know, controlled telecoms to really operate. There's other ways, but because they let it operate to a certain extent, that's kind of how it operates. But they, you know, there's taxation from the internet, so that's all fine with the state. You go to a state where free expression is not so valued by the state, it's a risk, it's heavily censored, right? Is it effective? No, not at all. Or not highly, right? You go to China, mm-hmm. there's a pretty heavy-handed censor operating in China. Who knows who it is? I don't know, but you can't get to certain sites. And, you know, your VPN and boom, you're there. So not so hard, but every once in a while, the VPN doesn't work and you're kind of jumping around trying to find your ways around it. So, you know, the internet has, you know, to the extent that people don't value free expression, it's censored. I don't know. So, you know, it's interesting to see Bowie come out and say, and other people come out and say, really, this is an act of rebellion. We're saying, no, we're not going to accept your restrictions and we're going to say what we want, which I think is great. And I think that's exactly what Bitcoin is. The term I use is it's an act of resistance.
Right? Yeah. Let me just for the sake of context, the interviewer said in that article, and it was 99, he says, you don't think that some of the claims that are being made for it are hugely exaggerated? You got to read, you know, the article for yourself. I mean, when the telephone was invented, people made amazing claims for it, blah, blah. And then David Boyd interjects. He says, I know the president at that time, he was outrageous. He said he foresaw the day in the future when every town in America will have a telephone. Now that, how dare he claim that? Absolute bullshit. In parentheses, sarcasm. So no, I don't agree. I think the internet, I don't think we have even seen the tip of the iceberg. I think the potential of what the internet is going to do to society, both good and bad, is unimaginable. I think we're actually on the cusp of something accelerating and terrifying, he says. And the interviewer says, still looking exasperated, is it just a tool, isn't it? And David interrupts him again and says, no, it's not. No, it's an alien life form. Is there life on Mars? Yes. And he just landed here, you know, as the artist and musician David, like, speaking. I found it hilarious. I mean, this, you know, this understanding of what it means structurally, fundamentally for society in totality. This is something I don't think mainstream people.
The man who fell to Earth.
Yeah, I think it goes to what Eric's saying, is that, you know, there's people who try to predict the future. They claim to be visionaries. Whether or not they are, we see. But I think the one thing that you can bet on is humans gravitating towards freedom of expression. And Bitcoin is a form of freedom of expression. You know, the internet is one for exchanging ideas and information freely. but, you know, Bitcoin is one for communicating and expressing value in a way that was previously restricted to, you know, a few restricted forms of a few restricted channels that were surveilled and, you know, constantly devalued. So for the first time, we can express our value in an international sense without control by the state. And I think that is something that, you know, you don't want to bet against something world changing like that. Similar to, you don't want to bet against the printing press suddenly allowing people to access knowledge in a way that was previously only controlled by, you know, state-based libraries or something like that, right? And so, you know, I think that human progress in general is a progress towards better and stronger individual sovereignty and an elaboration of what fundamental human rights are. I think that money is going to be something that becomes one of those key human rights that we find to be very, very important in our ability to share and communicate and store our time and energy.
Well, yeah, I agree, Connor. I agree. I think, you know, the way that you talk about the printing press, and I'm sure that there were state actors at the time that didn't like the idea of people being able to print their own books. You know, the whole who controls the present, or who controls the past controls the present. And they knew that very well, that the technology went on anyway, and eventually, you know, worked itself everywhere. And then the digital printing press, the internet itself, kind of did the same thing. And they were trying to control it, and they've realized that there are parts of it they can't really control. And I think now we have the digital monetary printing press, and there will be governments that try to control it, and there will be maybe governments that embrace it. But like you say, it's a progress of tools. I think that's actually the smartest thing that the reporter said about the internet, that it is really a tool. All technology is just different tools. Mm-hmm. And I think when technology really expands and evolves, that generally technology brings power to individuals, not to, you know, large nation states, I think. I think we're going in the right direction, is what I'm trying to say.
Unfortunate analogy, the money, the digital money printing press, you know, might be. I would add a little historical color to the printing press analogy. At the time, the first book printed was the Bible, right? The Gutenberg Bible, the printing press. And at the time, the church, like the Roman, the Catholic Church, generally interpreted the Bible for people. That was the job of a preacher or priest, right?
Which was a nation state, right? Which was tied to the states at the time.
They were closely coupled. In the case of the Catholic Church, it is the state and still runs the Vatican State. And so, you know, you had this control. The big issue with the Reformation began with, paying your way into heaven. I forget the term for it, but, so the idea that you could print your own, you could print books cheaply, especially the Bible, was very dangerous, and the printing press was banned. And that was the first big step, right? I mean, obviously, well, we'll just ban it, and then people won't be able to get these Bibles. But what it led to is people printing the Bible, and people therefore understand, you know, interpreting it themselves, and then realizing that some of the things that were being done were not consistent with what was said in the Bible, and that led to Martin Luther and the and it led to a very large scale war in Central Europe with a lot of dead people, because people had to resist that attempt to control this new technology. It is a very proper analogy, and we see that when the state fears that it actually is going to lose control, it starts mattering. Then they will act, and the first thing to do is to say, well, you can't do that anymore, and then that pushes it to the fringes. But people continue to do it, and they'll actually come out and do something else, right? Enforcement, and they did. But technology is a tool. It's kind of hard to put the cat back in the bag, and so it just keeps going. And in that case, it did allow people to learn to do what they wanted to do. And what's the objective of a free society? It's nothing but to be free. It's not to be, you can say it's to be wealthier, but what does it mean to be wealthier? It just means to do what you want, right? And so the objective here is not, to create a great pay make, to increase GDP, or, it is just to allow people to do what they want to do. And who stops that, right? That's just aggression. It's formalized it's formalized in the state. And modern states tend to draw their power from the people, from the fact that people are ignorant, or they endorse it, right? So we're not just just fighting this entity of the state. You're really fighting all these other people that don't understand. You just want to get outside of that system and let people do what they want to do. And sure, there was a lot of people that said, you know, that agreed with the church and that, you know, interpreting the Bible yourself is not a good thing because the church said so, right? But nevertheless, some people, some individuals decided that was not the case, and they wanted to do what they wanted to do anyway.
And the individual right not to be stolen from, right? I mean, isn't it also about, I know it's an overall freedom, is the overall expression, but it's about like creation of value, you know, entrepreneurship, property rights. I mean, we're...
fundamental principle of freedom is that not to be stolen from, right?
Exactly, yeah.
Right,
thank you.
One crime.
Yeah, thanks.
Comes down to it, right? And aggression is how we describe that crime of you know, stealing from people. So the state has formalized aggression, and a lot of people just don't understand that. What I'm getting at is that the bulk of individual people even may not even understand or care or agree with what a small group of, you know, technology people are trying to do. But that's okay. I mean, you know, it takes time for people to embrace certain, you know, new technologies and to embrace their own freedom. But somebody has to lead the way, and that's, you know, that's Gutenberg and all the others that followed that persisted in this idea that, you know, we want to say what we want to say, and just for the fact that we want to, and, you know, that's what makes us wealthier because it's what we want.
Well, that's what I think is really interesting, that, you know, people don't care, and, you know, I try to talk to my friends about this sometimes, and people are like, yeah, that's interesting, you know, and they just move on with their lives. But what they do care about,
I remember, I'm an old guy. Yeah, you know, they didn't care about the internet, right? It was how is that important to me? Right?
Totally, Eric. I was 10 years old, and I was on the internet, and all my friends were like, "Come play outside," and I was like, "No, you don't understand this
You're
thing."
One of those kids.
Oh yes, and but what's really interesting about this is obviously they do care now, you know. And I was in the second wave of that, you know, I think in 2000 or whatever, I had the Sony Clié. It was a Palm Pilot that was very similar to an iPhone today. And I had this computer in my pocket. People are like, "Why do you have a friggin' computer in your pocket? Like, what's wrong with you? You know, let's go play outside. Let's go get drunk." And I'm like, "No, you don't understand. This thing is coming." And of course, you know, again,
sure.
But what they do care about, and that's what's really interesting about Bitcoin, is orange coin number go up. People care about that. And
but what if it doesn't? Right? What if it doesn't?
Sure. For sure.
Is that what's important? I mean, it's important from a securities perspective, right? But the price on the money.
Important from an incentive perspective, but.
Well, okay, but let's assume, and we can tell the Bitcoin price does not always go up.
Is it okay?
Is it now no longer an important technology?
No, I'm not saying that, but
right. So, because
well, let's say it stays at 10,000 for the next 20 years.
Oh yeah. My God.
Let's say the Bitcoin purchasing power doesn't ever change, right? It stays where it is. Is it an important technology?
I still think it definitely is important technology.
Right. So what we're trying to say is pinning the hopes of the technology on the assumption that it always increases purchasing power faster than the return on, you know, the market return on capital, right? Which
sure.
is, you know, the global interest rate of, say, 8 to 10%, you know, if it always exceeds that, then it's valuable. Otherwise, it's not. And I think that's a gross misconception and not ideal for the evolution of what we're talking about, which is a system that allows people to trade with less taxation, right, freely.
Mm-hmm. I think that it's going to be valuable regardless, but I think that the big world-changing value of Bitcoin would be lost if it just stays stagnant at 10,000. Let's say the market cap today stays where it is. I mean, the big goal in my mind is separating money from the state. And if that doesn't happen, that will be disappointing for me, certainly. I mean, there's a lot left on the table.
Take gold as an example. Pretty stable in purchasing power throughout its history. Very, very, very important, this money.
But with short-term volatility, right? With short-term volatility, short-term.
So because I find these terms to be, you know, these terms are generally financial terms, not economic terms.
Yeah.
And I tend to speak primarily in economic terminology because that's what those are the forces that matter. Financial comes down to regulation and you know, other things that are kind of the implementation details. So we talk about stability and volatility as if they're opposites, and they're not. You have volatility and non-volatility, right? The tendency of prices to change. Well, of course prices change because prices are subject, value is subjective, right? Both on the supplier side and the, you know, demand side of something. And, you know, if you're trading apples for oranges, I mean, who's the supplier and, you know, who's the demander, right? They're trading partners, and each has a subjective idea of value. And so therefore prices change. And, you know, for a lot of reasons, prices change. You can't eliminate volatility, which is this measured in standard deviation from a norm, right? You have higher and lower volatility, but stability is a different concept, right? Stability in the engineering sense is the tendency of something when disturbed to return to equilibrium. It's not a standard deviation from a norm. So I separate these two concepts. And again, this is my terminology because these are two separate ideas that need different words. So I have to explain it so that people know what I'm talking about. But stability in my description is the tendency of, in this case, a money to return to some norm. Now the norm can change, but gold has had a very strong tendency to be stable, as has just about every other thing that exists in the world, right? Because of the law of supply and demand. When price rises because of, say, rising demand, supply tends to increase, therefore stabilizing volatility, right? Deviations from that norm that you can measure with standard deviation. But that returning to the norm is a consequence of the fact that more can be produced when more is demanded. So that's gold is subject to those forces, and that's why it, like just about everything else. Now, Bitcoin is unique in some way in that its supply can't be increased when demand increases. So people look at that simple idea and say, well, it's unstable, right? Now you think I'm talking about volatility, but I'm not. I'm talking about the idea that it will always rise. That's instability. It doesn't return to a norm when there's a, when the, you know, the idea is of instability of rising forever is that it's not returning to some norm. So what people miss in that calculus is that even though Bitcoin has a limited supply, right, never can be exceeded, it has other things that no other commodity in the world or thing in the world has, which are integrated fees, right? There's no integral fee. When a lot of people are trading gold, the price of me handing you a piece of gold does not go up. But with Bitcoin, it does. So the more transaction demand there is, the more costly it becomes to transact, which is a negative pressure on demand, which produces stability. So Bitcoin is ultimately stable because of that, but for a different reason than gold and everything else. So I believe it's fairly obvious from that Bitcoin is not an unstable money, which is a good thing, right? Unstable money is not ideal money. You want it to have fairly consistent purchasing power over time. Of course, we have a phase we're going through where, you know, fees are still low enough that they're fairly inconsequential, but we've seen points in time when they're not. And that has possibly caused people to, you know, draw back their demand. And that, we saw that when we hit the 20,000 spike, fees got extraordinary, and that was the subject on everybody's mind. So I believe ultimately that Bitcoin has volatility like everything else, but it's also stable, which is what we want. And we can't presume that its value is based on creating some kind of a rational return on capital. It's irrational that you could perpetually create a return on your investment that exceeds market arbitrage would destroy that.
Yeah, I'd also add to that, that you know, you said what this conjecture about Bitcoin its price going up forever. Well, what are you measuring it against, right? You're measuring against the tool that everybody measures prices against, the US dollar, right? So, or are you measuring against goods themselves, purchasing power of goods, right? So how we measure that's important too. And I do love your conjecture about this, about the fees being, a downward pressure on the price. And I think that makes a lot of sense. But also, as Bitcoin scales, you know, there's SegWit, there's block size increases that are possible. There's Lightning Network, there's Liquid, and probably other scaling solutions that will happen too.
I've explicitly said that something like layering, right, has this effect of potentially of increasing the amount of transaction throughput without increasing level of fees. However, that's a new equilibrium point, but it also implies that you're trading something to get there, right? You're trading localized security in something like Lightning for this. And you can trade even further, and you can go to Coinbase and trade completely off chain. Right, and a lot of ways to achieve this, but they all qualify as a trade-off. And even in those cases, the fees push back up into those additional layers. So you're getting less security, and you're still getting the fees. And so eventually, you hit another in a trade-off for localized security. What you want to avoid from a technology standpoint is you want to avoid system-wide trade-offs in security, right? So, I mean, they're always made. Any block size, for example, is a trade-off, right? And you can make it big enough, so now you can't operate at small scale, and now you've made a significant trade-off in security for transaction throughput, which is oddly what Satoshi suggested at one point, right? That we just centralize all the mining, and therefore we get a lot of transaction throughput with a lot of volume. Yeah, you're going to reach this point where you have a sustainable, acceptable level of trade-off in the black market where you can still operate and you get a certain level of throughput and you have a certain equilibrium that's been reached due to fees. If you take Lightning, for example, there's a lot of assumptions about it that there's some that don't seem to hold up, right? You open a channel, you have to be able to close that channel for it to be secure, which means you have to be able to confirm your transaction on chain. You have to pay the fee. So just to open the channel, you have to be willing to pay the current fee. Mm-hmm. All right. What if the current fee is, you know, purchasing power, $1,000? You're going to do a micro transaction? You're going to open that transaction? Right. So the fees are real, even though you can imagine amortizing them over a large number of transactions. You have to be willing to risk them just to start. So
yeah, they don't disappear altogether, right?
Amortization, and then there's the real effect of opening. So these are things that don't go, is what I'm suggesting.
One thing I want to add on the volatility point, I think that, you know, the volatility, like Eric was saying, is just a function of its true scarcity. And the fact that the price shifts so dramatically is more a result in, you know, it demonstrates Bitcoin's ability to accurately signal subjective valuation, right? And that's what's so important about a monetary base and what's so unique to Bitcoin is that because the supply is truly capped, then we can have the most accurate base possible, really, for a pricing system to be built on top of it. Because even when you have a monetary system like gold, which doesn't have a true cap, and when the price of gold per ounce increases, then you can have supply distortions, right? Because suddenly mining is more profitable, more gold supply hits the market. Because it's more valuable suddenly, because more people are using it. There's industrial uses of gold that create their own distortions in prices that are priced in gold. So with Bitcoin, it's pure monetary object. It has a pure cap. And so the volatility is really just a direct function of subjective valuation changing, and then can build a much more stable monetary base at the bottom. And I think that If we're really concerned about volatility, the terrifying volatility is the volatility you see when you have a financial system built on a soft money. You know, like the bubbles and the bursts that we're seeing in the global financial system, 2008 being one example, who knows what the next one's going to be, is really terrifying volatility because it's a systemic distortion in price at the very bottom, a mispricing of risk. That leads to mispricing all throughout the economy and then suddenly results in extreme volatility and just destruction of people's wealth that they really thought they had. And so when you build a foundation on something like Bitcoin, then you can have a much more accurate representation of price and a much better functioning economy. You'll still have some credit, crises back and forth, but you're not going to have a systemic price distortion that can really cause terrifying volatility, I think.
Yeah, I mean, I don't disagree. The idea that big shock, which is right, you're referring to, say a huge, this happened with silver, right? When the Comstock lode was discovered in Virginia City, the silver price dropped, and I don't know if it ever recovered. Mm-hmm. Or the gold supply shock when I forget his name, the richest man that ever lived, took his gold to Mecca, and was trying to help everybody out by buying everything, in sight. The purchasing power of gold dropped dramatically for an extended period of time. So those are supply shocks, and Bitcoin is not subject to supply shock, but price is a function of supply and demand. And this comes back to the stability property I was talking about. Demand also can have the same effect on price. So Bitcoin is subject to demand shock, and a great example of this would be, say, a global ban in the white market or a large scale one, right? That's a demand shock, a big one. So there are, or things like Facebook announcing it's gonna make a shitcoin, right? There's a demand shock, an increase versus a decrease, but still volatility. So you have a stable money that is subject to volatility nonetheless. Better to not have supply shock? Sure. But what we're really talking about is elimination of the tax cost of the money. And that is really only possible in the black market. So you have the benefits you're describing, I think, do exist. I mean, there is a benefit to to not having supply shocks in the black market, where it can and will operate. But the idea that it will be some sort of perfect money or ideal money Nash. Yeah, the ideal money in the Nash. I think that's all kind of a fantasy that everybody will peg everything to this idea of a global ideal money. I mean, even the idea of a peg is silly. Who controls the peg, right? So, better money, lower tax money, permissionless to the extent that we can pay for it. Yeah, definitely. But certainly not ideal in that sense. Not maybe more ideal, but not perfectly ideal.
All right. Well, I think there won't. I don't know. I have a hard time imagining a world where money doesn't converge after Bitcoin now. And so, in the short term, yes, but maybe 50 years from now, why would there be multiple monies? And why wouldn't the demand for, if Bitcoin is the global money, then demand would be relatively constant because everyone wants money. I mean, demand for money doesn't, if it's the global money, it wouldn't really change.
I lost my... I remember. Yeah, you're kind of alluding to Gresham's law, right? Or Thier's law, which is the inverse of Gresham's law. Gresham's law says everybody uses the shitty money because it's price controlled, right? In the presence of exchange controls, people use the
right
the crappier money, the one that's subject to inflation, et cetera, and they hoard the better money. But Thier's law is when you remove the idea of exchange controls, which is what we're kind of presuming in Bitcoin, right? When there's no exchange controls, then everybody uses the better money. It's cheaper. Well, those exchange controls don't go away in the white market, right? They go away in the black market. So this is one of the reasons why I describe Bitcoin as a black market money. That's where you get the benefit. You go into the white market and now you're putting your passport photo to be able to trade. Therefore, your transactions are monitored. Therefore, you're paying those taxes. You may be only able to trade using Fed coin in the white market, which is subject to inflation, right? So people will converge on the best money possible in the absence of exchange controls. But in the presence of them, they'll use the worst money possible because its price is is controlled, so it's truly sure. valuable, and so people want to spend it, and they want to hoard the stuff that's more valuable. So convergence implies a global free market, right? Without that, what Gresham's law implies is that it won't converge. So you could imagine, I use this when I describe, various altcoins. And when I talk about Bitcoin, I'm not talking about BTC. I'm talking about anything that conforms to the rules that secure Bitcoin that are laid out by Satoshi in the white paper, because he coined the term Bitcoin. And you could have any number of Bitcoins that have redundant value proposition, right? They're basically the same. And you would expect those to converge because there's no reason to suffer an exchange cost between them, right? Now, there may become a reason. And we see that, say, gold, silver, platinum, other commodity monies that get used even in the black market, right? There's different reasons to use different ones because they don't have the exact same value proposition. They have different characteristics, heavier, different colors, whatever. It's possible that you could have multiple Bitcoins that exist concurrently because they have different value propositions. It's provable that if they don't, they will converge. But in the presence of foreign exchange controls, you're still going to see that divergence due to Gresham's law.
Which is why I think Bitcoin is so interesting, because it is the most resistant to capital controls.
Right. Well, let that sink in.
Yeah. That'll just...
Listen, guys, we got to wrap this. I don't want to, overload my listeners too much because this is like amazing session today. Either one or two or both questions, if you still have time. I know, Ben, you got to go, right? You got to go. You said you had let me just, one question is, Satoshi Nakamoto, whoever that was, could have set the fixed supply with 21 million, 15 million. All right. So it's not about the amount. It's like it's got to be absolute scarcity, right? The absolute fixed limited supply. Now, there's this talk about, speculation about how many coins already lost, could have been lost because of death, lost private keys and stuff. And I don't want to speculate, but
voting accidents.
Yeah. what would be if let's just for the sake of simplicity, let's just say really like 2 million or 4 million coins. Finally lost. What does it mean? I think I could never figure out is that a fundamental meaning to it?
No, Rothbard talks about this.
In total circulation,
But any supply of money is will work just fine as long as there's divisibility. So it doesn't matter what the number is. Yes, the 21 million is what we always talk about, but whatever that number ends up being, it doesn't matter. I think the fact that some are getting lost actually means that the supply is would be contracting from that 21 million, but over time, I believe that will probably taper off to be a very small number.
No, because there's this quote from Satoshi Nakamoto in some of his correspondence. It says, yes, if some of the coins are lost, the value of those coins sort of, I don't know what's the word of it, converge or transfer to the value of the other coin holders. Remember Eric or Connor, Ben, remember there's a quote like
well I think that one thing I've been thinking about in relation to this lately is, if let's say quantum computing does come online, mm-hmm. which it's debatable, some people don't even think it's ever going to exist, but if it does exist, and let's say we 20 years from now add quantum resistant signatures to Bitcoin, everyone moves their coins to quantum resistant keys. If there are 4 million coins lost, those coins aren't going to move to quantum resistant keys. Mm-hmm. And in that sense, Bitcoin does what we think it's going to do, and it continues becoming this global reserve asset. Then whichever nation state or group achieves quantum first is going to be like the wealthiest group in the world. I mean, it's going to be, has potential to be like wild, right? And maybe the next world superpower is the one who gets quantum first and unlocks the keys. because if they are truly lost, then they're going to be exposed to quantum attacks. And that's something that weird thing to think about. I haven't really talked about this with other people. I'm curious what other people think about this.
It's an interesting observation that lost coins that can't be converted will be consumed and converted by somebody who, the first person who's able to break the keys. And I think that's a very reasonable assumption. Although, you know, it's hard to say, you know, that price is also not affected by such a scenario. So in terms of actual value, but relative value, you know, somebody's going to pick up a lot of coins once they can convert those keys. And that's, if we assume quantum computing is inevitable, then it's inevitable that if one entity gets it first, that they can then go collect all the lost coins. I believe that's a very true statement.
Yeah, and then you have a massive incentive when then like a $1 trillion asset, then you have massive incentive to just throw billions of dollars in quantum research to be the first one to get it, like a race to quantum.
Absolutely, let's do it.
Yeah.
Come on, guys. That's like 20-30 years, right? I mean, that's would be like a realistic scenario in like is that true? I don't know. Maybe it's DARPA already working on it, but it's like, you know, these time frames, you know, like 20-30 years usually. Or is it going to be faster because of the exponential rate of pace of technology? Anyway, it's just speculation.
Let's assume it's inevitable, right? I believe it's inevitable that computing will continue to increase in power, right? Mm. Satoshi made that fairly clear as well. Like, you know, in terms of invoking Moore's law to describe the, you know, necessary, the ability to continue to store the chain even. So let's assume it's possible. I think the conclusion is correct that somebody, I mean, maybe it'll happen concurrently, and you know, but if I was doing it, I would have tried to figure out where all those lost coins are up front, and then just did it all at once. And you know, a few seconds, I've transitioned all those coins to now resistant outputs. So, but you know, another economic principle that observed is that having an individual that's very wealthy, you know, is presumed to be perpetual, and generally wealth tends to dissipate pretty quickly, because having money is not wealth until you spend it. Right? You don't have the things you want until you spend the money. So wealthy people tend to spend a lot of money, and you know, if they don't invest it wisely, they tend to lose it all. And holding Bitcoin is not investment. That's another kind of commonly held fallacy. It's hoarding, right? It's not a cause of production. It doesn't produce anything, which means it doesn't produce any return. This idea that price always rises, which we've already discussed, is speculatory, which means it's a zero-sum game, ultimately, unless you have an unstable money, which all that means is that everybody jumps in until the speculative game again. So, you know, the idea that you have all this purchasing power, but you never use it, that's kind of irrelevant. And when you start using it, either to maintain it, which means investing, means you give it to somebody else for some period of time, you know, tends to dissipate money pretty quickly. And we see this in nation states or countries or regions where, you know, say the King of England has amassed incredible wealth because, you know, the sun never sets on the UK Empire. But, you know, eventually that dissipated over time. So it's not necessarily a doomsday scenario is all I'm describing, like somebody having a large amount of something. Satoshi's got a large amount.
Yeah.
You know, if he wanted to start spending it, what would that mean? It would just mean that other people have it now. Yeah.
I would argue the current system is far worse, because I believe through asset inflation that the wealthy disproportionately gain from inflation, while the poor have no store of value.
Yeah, that's because that's where the money's pumped.
Far worse, because it keeps those people on top.
If you hold your capital in cash, you pay the inflation tax. And wealthy hold a lower percentage of their capital in cash if they're smart, because they don't want to pay that tax, right? So they want to get market rate.
And they can afford to. They can afford to hold illiquid vaults of store value assets.
Percentage of your net worth is not being consumed, and therefore not held in cash. So yeah, inflation tends to hit, you know, and things in taxes tend to hit lower income people more significantly.
But But I'm talking about this paradigm today of, you know, that there's push for socialism to redistribute the wealth because of all the robber barons have amassed too much capital, and that they're the problem, the billionaires. All of my, you know, people that I know that are young, or not all of them, but a lot of them are saying, oh, it's these rich billionaires that are the problem. And I think it's the system that's keeping them on top that's the problem, not the fact that they're rich.
Right? I mean, this is the road to serfdom.
That's what I was trying to get
right? at. Right? I mean, that's Hayek's idea, that the more government intervention that tries to remedy these wrongs is just going to lead to more problems and distribution, and you know, it's like
stratification,
running cycle.
Economy is not a zero-sum game. It doesn't matter that somebody's wealthier than you, right? That doesn't hurt you in any way. It's when people use aggression against you that it hurts you in terms of being free or not being free. Somebody has money and they want to hire you to do something, and you're perfectly willing to do that. You do it. I mean, that's doesn't hurt you. So just the idea that there's an inherent evil in something, some people being much wealthier than other people is itself a fallacy. Mm-hmm. It's a non-wrong. I think we seem to agree on the fact that, you know, when the state intervenes and tries to either correct these wrongs or maybe not, right? That's when you tend to get these greater disproportions. But the disproportion itself is not the problem. People are not all the same. Not all going to value the same things in terms of their time and what they do and, you know, how much they save. Equality is not a goal.
Right? In a fair system should be a goal.
Well, the only definition of fairness is everybody trades freely.
Right.
All right. Concluding, final question. Libra, Calibra, Facebook's, whatever, global coin, surveillance coin, what you want to call it, is it going to smoothen, facilitate, accelerate the consciousness of people understanding, questioning the essence of money and just, you know, being attracted to Bitcoin finally? Is it going to facilitate that?
I think it definitely will have some, I think it definitely is moving to, you know, the public consciousness away from money has to be controlled by states. Now it is backed by assets that are, you know, controlled by state actors. So in some ways it's not moving that far away. I think it is a good thing in that sense that it's showing, I think if anything, it'll prove the value prop of Bitcoin. Because, you know, you have to ask yourself a question with Libra. Will you be able to send $10,000 to Iran? If yes, then it's going to be shut down by regulators. And if no, then it's PayPal, right?
Yeah.
And so either way, it's going to prove Bitcoin's value prop. You know, maybe it'll help people in remittances. But I think it's net good. It'll be interesting to see how regulators treat it. The only concern I would have is that maybe this pulls the demonstrates to politicians that there is a threat to their monopoly on central banking sooner than we would like. Because right now they're not treating Bitcoin seriously, but if they treat Facebook very seriously as a threat to their power, you know, it doesn't take much to look a little bit further down the line and realize Bitcoin is the real threat the entire time. So I don't know. It brings up a lot of interesting questions. We'll see what happens with regulators.
Yep. Thank you so much.
Which also goes to Eric's point. Eric's point about that, you know, Bitcoin isn't just BTC. It's this movement of non-sovereign monies, and that, you know, they smashed down Libra, they smashed down Bitcoin, and then, you know, what's next? I mean, it's very hard to put this cat back in the bag. Libra has been discussed ad nauseum, but I think, you know, Connor's point about that it forces people to think about, you know, non-state money and what the implications of that are. It's like getting people to finally care about what we've been talking about, right? When we said, oh, they'll only care when orange coin number goes up. Well, this is a way to make them be like, huh, what's going on here? Why is Libra, is it just PayPal, or are they actually creating a brand new money? And that starts the conversation. And I think that's what we're having this conversation. As Eric says, we can't know the future. So let's talk about what, you know, what this new paradigm really means.
My opinion is just PayPal, and that's really all you have to say about it. But and to fill in a hole I left before, the term I was looking for with respect to the church and the Reformation was indulgences, right? The idea that you pay some tax to the church and you get your way into heaven. Mm-hmm. I don't know. great talk. I always enjoy it.
Me too. Thank you so much. I enjoyed so much and I learned so much. I'm sure my listeners did, and very enlightening, very deep, and very, you know, really, you know, from every facet. I think we've covered a lot of facets. That's always good. So a pretty holistic picture. Well, guys, gentlemen, thank you so much. Eric, Connor, Ben, and hopefully talk to you soon, maybe in a different constellation or same constellation, different topics. People enjoy that so much.
Yeah, thank you so much for having me on.
Thank you. Bye-bye. All right, if you love this interview, this panel discussion, don't forget, security comes first. Get yourself a Trezor wallet. There are some other, you know, applications, easy cheesy, you know, user-friendly applications. I'm not being sponsored, all right, at least not yet by them, but, you know, go to serious, credible, trustworthy exchanges such as Kraken. I'm a huge fan of them, their ethos, their professionalism, their up-to-date, top-notch security updates, whatever, their communication style. Amber, Dropbit, Trezor. These are, you know, I have personal experiences with these products, and support me, like this video, share this video, subscribe, push the notification bell button, follow me on Twitter, LinkedIn, social media, Facebook, on my podcast, on my website, kvandavani.com. Support me in any shape or form you can, because this keeps the independence, you know, the flow, the speed, and, you know, the educational purpose behind this, all right, this whole thing. Behind this, the Total Connector show. All right, my name is Kevin Davani. I'll talk to you soon. Thank you so much for watching.